You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although cell phones haven't been around all that long, people in the United States and other wealthy countries have already started to take them for granted. In the world's poorest countries, there's a cell phone revolution going on, and it's attracting billions of dollars in foreign investment and creating hundreds of millions of rural income opportunities. Joining me for the first part of our Underreported today is Nicholas P. Sullivan, author of You Can Hear Me Now, How Microloans and Cell Phones Are Connecting the World's Poor to the Global Economy. It's published by Wiley. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
When did the cell phone revolution in the developing world begin?
Well, I guess if you really want to trace it back to the beginning, it was in Bangladesh, which is the main story I focus on in the book. Phones were introduced in 1997. Actually, in South Africa, there were cell phones starting in 1994. And, of course, South Africa would have to be considered a developing country, although it's richer than, certainly far richer than places like Bangladesh and Pakistan and the rest of sub-Saharan Africa. So I would say, really, it's kind of 97, 98 is when it really began, both in South Asia and in Philippines and in sub-Saharan Africa.
Was it inevitable that these countries would eventually start catching up to the wealthiest nations in terms of cell phone use, because it's the only way that those people can use telephones in areas that aren't wired for conventional telephones?
Well, yes, if you look at it from that perspective, it was inevitable, because it really was the only way it was going to happen. Certainly the governments that were running the state-owned networks were not going to build out the networks into the rural areas. But still, it really happened because of just entrepreneurial drive and people taking a risk, because certainly the big phone companies at the time, the big multinational phone companies, wouldn't have gone in without kind of native entrepreneurs like Iqbal Khadr in Bangladesh and Mohammed Ibrahim in sub-Saharan Africa. It was their kind of drive that convinced the foreign investors that it was worth the risk, and so they pumped the money in to build the networks, even though they weren't quite sure that people living on $1 or $2 or $3 a day would actually be able to afford the cell phones.
They also have to put up satellites and antenna tower systems?
Well, they had, by and large, the cell phone base stations replaced satellite. They had been using satellite phones here and there, but satellite phones were very expensive to operate, and not that the signal was not that clear. So, no, these are regular base cell towers like we have in the United States. And so it's much more efficient and affordable. And, of course, the thing that really made it take off is this the whole new paradigm of shared phones. So you'd have one phone in a village that people would come and lease time on. Or and also the whole prepaid phones, which really, it started in Europe, but it really took hold in the developing world. So that instead of having monthly bills, you'd be able to buy increments as low as 10, 20, 50 cents, and just use as much as you could afford. So it's that kind of what I refer to as a new paradigm that is so non-Western that really made it catch on.
How does cell phone availability translate into GDP growth? Are there any tangible signs that it's actually improving the conditions of people in the poorest countries?
Well, certainly, yes, there definitely is. I mean, if you look at the GDP growth of even sub-Saharan Africa, which from 1980 to 2000 was basically experiencing negative growth, is now, as a whole, growing 4 to 5% a year, which is still not really enough to pull everyone out of poverty. But certainly the technology has had a lot to do with that. And there are two ways that it affects the kind of larger GDP. One, of course, is just in to reach people in remote rural areas, you need a large supply chain. And those are mostly indigenous entrepreneurs. So you have people who are selling the phones, people who are selling prepaid cards, people who are going around with batteries and car batteries to charge the phones. So there's a lot of just entrepreneurial activities, not to mention the jobs that are created to put up the base stations and to service the network. But the other way it really is improving the GDP and the economy is because it's giving people access to market information, pricing information, which they never really had before. And so farmers, say, or fishermen who would used to, who once had to sell their catch or their produce to a wholesaler at a given price, can now shop around for the best price. And
they can find out what things are going for in other parts of the world.
Exactly. And that's why I think that it's really it's that connection to the rest of the world and the market economies of the rest of the world that is really changing things. And there have been studies, say, microeconomic studies this last year in India showing that the fishermen there have increased their profits by 8 to 10%, and the price to consumers has dropped by 4%. And that's a study done of before cell phones and after cell phones, and it's just because people can shop around and find not only the best price, but the prices tend to level out and become fair and equitable on both sides of the aisle. So, but it's not just the pricing information; it's also just the ability to communicate. You know, people are saving so much time and money. For instance, in Bangladesh, it used to cost to travel from a village with no phone into Dhaka, the main city, to talk to a relative, to do business with anyone, would take a day or two. So making a phone call is 8 to 10 to 20 times cheaper than that in terms of, so there's that, and also just the collaboration of people being able to communicate with each other and bounce ideas off one another and to advertise their businesses and be reached. All these things collectively are just generating what I refer to in the book as income opportunities. They're not necessarily jobs, though there are jobs, but it's just income opportunities that weren't there before.
Well, if you ask most Americans about living conditions in Bangladesh, they're likely to quote an ad campaign for a charity and tell you that most Bangladeshis live on a dollar a day. They will tell you that people in sub-Saharan Africa need a couple of dollars to stave off malnutrition. Do you think this type of foreign investment should be encouraged over the more traditional foreign aid approaches?
Well, one of the major themes of the book is that this kind of foreign investment compared to traditional foreign aid is much, much more effective. I mean, certainly humanitarian aid or post-disaster relief and so forth is needed. But aid to governments has not been used productively versus foreign investment in a commercial business, which has been showing great profits for both the companies but also for the end users, kind of a Henry Ford-type inclusive capitalism. So I think if you compare it not to humanitarian aid but to foreign aid to governments, and governments, we were usually in the capital city, they were just sucking up the money, and it was creating corruption, which still exists, of course, and huge bureaucracies and red tape. The money was never being used to facilitate business, it was never spread into the countryside at the grassroots. It was always kind of very centralized and controlled money. So, I mean, it's a combination of the foreign investment that these countries have never had before, and the technology, the grassroots technology that has just taken on a life of its own.
Does it give them access to banks that they might not have otherwise? After all, there aren't banks in many of these remote villages. Are there banks that have signed on to make services available by cell phone?
Yes, in fact, there definitely are. Just as there were no phones, there were no banks because it was too remote. And now, in many cases, it's the cell phone companies that are branding the kind of mobile banking enterprises. They're often affiliated with a bank for payments and so forth. But in South Africa, for example, there's MTN Banking after MTN, the cell phone company. And the whole mobile banking thing, to me, is the most fascinating aspect of this, because if you think that people who 2 years ago didn't have phones are now bank accounts are now transferring money by phone, And this this is true even at the very micro and the micro lending level to just kind of daily life, to remittances from the cities to the countryside, from overseas to the cities. And in the Philippines, people are using cell phones to pay their bills, to go into fast food outlets, in Africa to buy gas. And it's definitely increasing what economists call the velocity of money. And it's much, much safer than carrying cash around just because there's so many bandits, you know, in the rural areas.
Don't some experts predict that cell phones will bridge the digital divide without having to use PCs?
Yes, indeed. That is definitely beginning to happen. I mean, the cell phone, which really, in fact, is a computer after all, and it's more powerful than the computers that first took the Apollo mission to the moon, is being used as a mini PC, like a text-based internet device, you know, for a kind of a mid-level, access to the internet. So there's a lot of applications being written, kind of like Craigslist or eBay, those kind of trading and exchanging type systems that people are accessing via phone. Farm agricultural systems are sending out text messages to farmers about when to irrigate, when there's a storm coming. And so there's, it definitely is bridging the digital divide. It's still not a full-fledged PC, but the fact that the cell phone is so easy to master and that people get up to speed so quickly makes it probably more effective than a PC, which is overly complicated and time-consuming. And, of course, the other thing that people never realize when all these kind of, say, UN efforts to put PC kiosks and internet kiosks in the middle of remote areas is the energy needs. And most of these places don't have either don't have electricity at all or don't have a reliable source of electricity. So on all counts, the cell phone is really kind of the major technology player and force in throughout much of Africa and South Asia.
My guest is Nicholas P. Sullivan, who is the publisher of the journal Innovations, Technology, Governance, Globalization from MIT Press, the author of a couple of books, the most recent, You Can Hear Me Now, How Microloans and Cell Phones Are Connecting the World's Poor to the Global Economy. It is published by Wiley, the Jossie Bass imprint. Tell us a bit about Grameen Phone in Bangladesh. How was that partnership formed?
Well, that's quite interesting. That Grameen Phone is an offshoot of Grameen Bank, of course, which, you know, with Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize last year. And it was started when Iqbal Qadir, who was a Bangladeshi-American living in New York, an investment banker, his network went down and he realized he was cut off without connectivity. He was inspired to go back to Bangladesh and start a phone system and thought that he needed to partner with someone. And he wanted to partner with Grameen Bank initially to try to connect all their branches because they had branches in 69,000 villages. And Muhammad Yunus didn't really want to connect his branches by phone, but said that if you can find a way to bring make phones affordable to poor villagers, I'll back you. And so Qadir said, well, you're lending money to villagers to buy cows, microloans. Why can't you lend small amounts of money to people to buy phones? Just as they buy cows, they can lease out time on the phones to pay back the loans. And Yunus backed the idea conceptually, which gave Qadir the credibility to go out and attract Telenor, the Norwegian telecom, to come in and build the network. And it was Telenor that really put up the money and built the network.
Now, I would assume that there are some governments that would consider these developments dangerous. Are some deterring the growth of indigenous cell phone companies?
Yes. Well, yeah, that's a kind of a long story, but the answer is definitely yes. And
where? I'm assuming Burma is one of them.
Yes. Well, actually, to be honest, I don't know that much about Burma, but I do know that in the Philippines and in China and in Bangladesh, the cell phone networks have been shut down by the governments. you know, during elections, say. In Bangladesh, the government now, to make an international phone call, you still have, from a cell phone, you still have to go through the government-owned network, which goes through satellites, which is very expensive, which is very cumbersome. They just refuse to give up that kind of link to the revenues that are there. But nonetheless, I mean, the forces are just kind of overwhelming. There are now five or six, I believe, independent cell phone companies in Bangladesh. The same is true in throughout sub-Saharan Africa. The major thing that governments are doing now is taxing heavily the sale of handsets, the import of handsets. They have user fees and so forth. So they're, even though that Nokia now makes a $30 handset for use in the developing world, by the time all the duties and imports and taxes are levied on it, it's more like a $70 or $80 handset in most places. So the government is still kind of taking its pound of flesh, as it were, and but I think the forces are just, the price has been coming down primarily because of the competition. I mean, there are multiple players in all these markets, and the cell phone chargers are just kind of declining rapidly.
Now, can this be applied to developing? I mean, we're talking about developing countries, but can this be applied to a country like the United States, where there are cut off areas as economically, where I imagine people are living in the equivalent of third world conditions?
Well, that is a great question, and you know, I hadn't even really thought about it when I was working on this book, but since then I've actually done some work with this company called TracFone, which is based in Miami and is a prepaid phone company only that is catering to basically low-income Americans, selling, you know, prepaid phones in Walmart with 300 minutes for $14, $15. And often it's people who don't have the credit ratings or the income to pay monthly phone bills, you know, between credit cell phone bills, which can, you know, as you well know, get up into the hundreds of dollars very quickly, and it's just huge segments of the population cannot afford that. So the answer is definitely yes, TracFone, and now, of course, all the major cell phone carriers have a prepaid option, and it's basically catering to the large segments of the population that cannot or don't want to spend the money on a monthly contract phone.
Did you get interested in this story when Grameen Bank won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006?
Well, actually, my book was just about to be it was published a few months after that. So I had basically finished the book. Now, I got interested in the book actually over a period of years because I had met Iqbal Qadir, the Bangladeshi who started it. He was teaching at Harvard. I was living in Boston. I went to Bangladesh with him. I kept hearing his story, and I had written about entrepreneurship and in technology and for magazines for years, and so the whole story of entrepreneurship and technology in the developing world was really appealing to me. So it was just, for me, it was just a great business story at the outset. And the more I got into it, of course, the more the economic impact, the change, the transformative change. I love the Khaled Shams, who is the kind of director of Grameen Telecom, the branch that does the village phone in Bangladesh, refers to it as a silent revolution, because it happened so silently and surreptitiously that no one realized what was happening until suddenly there were phones everywhere, and it has transformed people's lives, their economic life, their social life, the way they interact, the way they travel, and so all that became much more important than just the plain business story. But it is a great business story as well, because it's been successful.
Thank you so much for talking with us. Nicholas P. Sullivan, his book, You Can Hear Me Now, How Microloans and Cell Phones Are Connecting the World's Poor to the Global Economy, published by the Jossie Bass imprint of Wiley. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much. I enjoy it, and good luck with your fundraising.
Thank you. We'll be right back.